It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania officials are taking a proactive approach to monitor and prepare for the coronavirus. That's according to State Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine, speaking yesterday on the heels of a new advisory from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They now say state and local health officials will need to be prepared for the spread of the virus in the United States. But at least here in Pennsylvania, optimism is ruling the day.
I would absolutely like to reassure Pennsylvanians that the Pennsylvania Department of Health, working with our county and municipal partners and other very important stakeholders, are prepared for any potential community spread of COVID-19.
Paul Goff of the Pittsburgh Business Times has been reporting on what state and local preparations involve for everyone from first responders and hospitals to businesses. He joins us now in studio. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pennsylvania Health Secretary Levine has repeatedly said no cases in Pennsylvania, but we seem to be preparing as if there will be. Paul, top line thoughts. What are you hearing and seeing from the response the last few days, especially since the CDC told everyone to get ready?
I think there has been a change in the tone and also more urgent messaging in terms of how to make this the residents and businesses and schools prepared. Just in case something like this happens, it's important to say there haven't been any cases in Pennsylvania. Nobody knows whether there will be, but everybody's on heightened alert.
What do preparations look like here in Pittsburgh? Let's start with your bread and butter, the business community. Does this have people worried?
I'm not sure that right this second it's become a major topic of conversation. I've talked to businesses, I've talked to employees, I've talked to people who are starting to get concerned and making plans, and I've also talked to people who don't think it's going to be an issue and not to be concerned about it. Where it is becoming heightened preparations and where there have been a lot of talk since the very beginning and planning has been in the healthcare community. So hospital systems, the UPMCs, the Allegheny Health Networks, smaller hospitals, healthcare providers, they are and have been preparing for cases to walk into their emergency rooms or primary care spots.
Dr. Kristen Mertz, the Allegheny County Health Department's medical epidemiologist, told me yesterday that if an outbreak arrives, she has the information and materials she needs.
As far as supplies are concerned, both the county and the state do have some stockpiles of supplies that they can make available to people who need them in times of emergencies.
Who would be those people to be first recipients of those kind of supplies?
Well, the people that we like to make sure have protection first are the first responders and the healthcare providers, because without those people working and healthy, it's hard to take care of everyone else. Most hospital systems and EMS providers have enough supplies. They are, you know, forward-thinking, and they're well-stocked for these kind of situations.
What authority does the health department have for even drastic actions, closing of schools or businesses or limiting travel?
We have the legal authority to quarantine and isolate people if they present a public health risk to the community. Generally, though, what we do is just make recommendations, and most partner agencies that we work with are very good at following state, local, and federal guidelines.
What is your game plan if cases are confirmed in Allegheny County? What is step one, step two, step three?
Well, at this point, we're mostly doing containment. So if a case were identified here, we would make sure that case is isolated so that that case could not spread the infection. And we would get in touch with all their contacts, anybody they had been in close contact with during the period that they're infectious. And then we would quarantine those contacts so that if they got sick, they wouldn't be passing it on to other people. But if we had started to get spread within the community, we would move to community mitigation measures.
What's that?
So that's basically measures to try to slow and reduce the burden of cases in the area. And it's things like the personal protective measures like hand hygiene, cough etiquette, staying home when you're sick. It's also the containment and quarantine, the isolation and quarantine that I mentioned. But it would also, as things got worse, involve social distancing, which means things like school closures, tailoring workplace activities so people aren't in close contact, encouraging telecommuting, teleworking, postponing mass gatherings if it came to that, and then trying to ease the burden on the healthcare system through telemedicine or triaging aggressively. The one thing about this virus, it seems that there are a lot of people who are only mildly ill or even asymptomatic, and so many people do not have to be hospitalized with this illness.
Are we prepared?
Yeah, I think we are getting ready. I think I'm hoping that preparations never need to come to fruition, but I think it's always better to be prepared in case we do get a lot of cases. And, you know, we've had years of experience trying to get ready for flu outbreaks, and there are studies and modeling and information out there to tell us what should help. So I think as long as people start thinking about it and getting ready and get prepared for this, I think there's a lot we can do to dampening the burden that it will bring.
Dr. Kristen Mertz is the medical epidemiologist for the Allegheny County Health Department. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Paul, what do you hear there from your reporting? Are you as optimistic?
I hear a lot of planning. I hear from both Dr. Mertz, who I spoke to yesterday, as well as other health officials and the health and hospital systems here, they've been preparing for a long time. They have plans that for potential widespread flu outbreak that they dusted off and started to add to with the COVID-19 in mind. I think that they know what to do. They know how to do it. And there's going to be obviously some things that change. It's, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect plan, but you know, they're ready. They've been working. I spoke to a doctor a month ago about the potential for supplies and how they were trying to get more because they knew they would need more. So they've been able to do that. I've heard that from health systems. So, and Dr. Mertz told you and also told me that they think they have enough supplies for the healthcare workers to be protected.
Do you know if schools and first responders have contingency plans? If a child gets diagnosed with this, could an entire school close?
That's a good and unanswered question. You know, things are changing so much here in this situation. You don't know. I mean, I spoke to a former government official yesterday, just sort of talking about what this person thought. And he really cautioned against panic and to be very, for journalists in particular, to be very measured about what they were saying and what they were messaging. And I think that's also wise words as well. So it's, you know, you walk a tightrope. You can hear that in the health officials, the CDC people, and also, you know, Dr. Mertz, you know, it may happen here. It may not. It's good to be prepared.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm in studio with Pittsburgh Business Times reporter Paul Goff. We've seen Wall Street take a couple of huge tumbles this week, 1,000 points, 800 points. That's been linked lately to the impact of coronavirus in several countries that are important links to the U.S. supply chain. What preparations are businesses locally taking or at least considering to deal with coronavirus if it comes here?
I would say that there's two levels of interest and planning. One, companies that have international operations in China, in the other places that are affected, they are already considering this to be something that's going to affect their business. You see that on Wall Street with the concerns with the stocks dropping. Apple is another company that's been concerned about their supply chain. So there's that level. And then there's also the level of what do we do about teleworking? What if we can't, you know, if there's an office that's closed, how do we handle that? Those questions are unanswered right now. And I think the health officials are saying, start having that discussion.
And what about businesses that can't operate through teleworking?
That's a question that I don't think anybody has an answer to right now. And hopefully it won't come to that.
We heard epidemiologist Dr. Kristen Mertz talk about containment and if it spreads, community mitigation. But then there is prevention. You've spoken to researchers at the University of Pittsburgh who are helping to develop a vaccine. Are they confident?
They are confident. they have said that there's that they think there'll be a vaccine. Now, there's a long time period for that. So the Center for Vaccine Research here in Pittsburgh, we have a long history going back to Jonas Salk about solving epidemiological problems, the polio vaccine. The Center for Vaccine Research at Pitt, they have a biocontainment lab that's one of the few in the country that can handle something like this securely and safely, and they are working diligently. They were able to get about 2 weeks ago a sample of the coronavirus, right, and they've been working on that.
But this is long-term. This cannot help with what's going on right now.
The vaccine, no. Dr. Fauci from the CDC mentioned that again in the NIH yesterday, but that's something for the future because this could be something with us seasonally.
You report that the threat of COVID-19 is also affecting how companies make the top-level decision. Pittsburgh-based drug maker Mylan and Upjohn added the potential impact onto its risk factors ahead of a merger.
Right. I suspect we'll hear more about that this afternoon because Mylan is going to have their annual or their quarterly conference call with investors, and I suspect that they're going to get questions about what it's impacting them, both on drug supply and then also on the potential merger.
So, Paul, what questions, stories will you be pursuing in the days ahead regarding coronavirus and particularly our region?
Looking at what the health systems are doing, continuing to do. We've written those stories. I've reported those stories. I'm likely to do another one really soon about that. Also, what businesses are planning. We always talk about, you know, this is a mitigation, a risk factor, like a lot of things in business, from what happens if you lose power or what happens if you have a snowstorm or a weather event that impacts your operations. I've heard as soon as last night and this morning, companies that are starting to really think about this and talking to their customers about the impact that it would have. And then others who are saying, well, we're not really sure this is going to impact us yet. And that's true. I mean, that's either approach is valid right now. This is something that they're looking at.
And we'll look forward to your continued reporting, Paul.
Thank you.
Paul Goff is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Business Times. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Healthcare has been cited as a top issue among voters this election cycle. We'll take a look at how varied opinions can be on that topic. And we'll visit a barbershop in South Central Pennsylvania where bubble-breaking political conversations come with your trim free of charge. Plus, a grant-funded repair project for the Brady Tunnel could serve as the missing link to create an Erie to Pittsburgh bike trail. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Leonard Nimoy made his debut as Spock in 1964 and played the character on Star Trek until the original series ran its course. He also played the iconic character in 8 feature films and various spin-offs. But did you know that Mr. Nimoy also recorded a handful of music albums in his day? Some of those albums were science fiction based, while others focused on popular music of the day. He even dipped his pointed ears into the world of writing songs himself. Leonard Nimoy passed away 5 years ago today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Girl meets boy. They fall in love. She says he's everything.
Flying accounts for just 2% of global carbon emissions, but it's growing, and there's no greener jet fuel on the horizon. So one climate scientist broke up with airplanes. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist and author. In 2010, he realized he'd flown 50,000 miles, mostly for his work. In 2012, Kalmus founded the website No Fly Climate Sci, where he and other scientists could talk publicly about scaling back their air miles. That year, he gave up flying completely.
I realized that 3/4 of my own carbon emissions were from flying. That was a revelation. I had no idea that flying was that carbon intensive in my own life. And so I thought, this is excessive. This number of meetings and conferences is excessive. My collaborators already know what I'm working on. It's like essentially the same 15-minute talk they saw 4 months ago with like a few tweaks on it. And sitting on that plane that last time in 2012, it didn't feel worth it. And, you know, I had two very small children at the time, and I was thinking about them and their future. You know, it really felt like I was stealing from them.
So what do you do instead?
Well, so I'm fortunate to live in Los Angeles. You know, I take the train or I drive. We recently got an electric car. It's actually a Tesla, so it's easy to go. It's just as easy to go on long trips as with a conventional gas car. Remote collaboration is easier than ever. You can work on papers remotely. So, you know, conferences in California and San Francisco. I went to one all the way on the East Coast of the United States once, and after I got back from that, I felt like that was too far to go. So I'm actually going to a meeting in April in Washington, D.C., you know, and I'll try to like make as many meetings as possible with other people that I want to see on the East Coast when I make that one, because that's, for me, that's a pretty rare thing.
One criticism I've heard, particularly about scientists not flying, is that you're probably pretty well established in your career, but not everybody is in that position yet.
Actually, it wasn't quite like that, because the same year I stopped flying, 2012, was the year I switched into earth science. So it was a little bit like becoming a graduate student all over again in a new field. It's just that this whole flying less conversation, I think it makes sense to those of us who recognize that this is literally a planetary emergency. There's a huge mountain of evidence that makes that very, very clear to me. Like, I don't have any ambiguity about kind of taking that stance. And I think that as climate impacts get more severe and happen more frequently, more and more people will come around to the same sense that this is indeed a planetary emergency. In that context, flying less makes a lot of sense. And when I weighed that against my career, the choice was really clear. Like, yeah, this might slow down my career a little bit, but in the context of this planetary emergency, it was absolutely the right choice for me.
Recently, I've seen a lot of climate articles that talk about consumer choices, like not eating meat or not flying, not being the solution to this climate crisis, that national policy changes on energy and transportation or international agreements to reduce carbon are the only pathways that matter. What do you say to that?
I think that's an excellent point, and I actually strongly agree with it. Doing something that kind of requires a sacrifice, like flying less, makes a strong symbolic statement. The power of these sorts of so-called individual changes is that they lead to the cultural shift and the growing awareness of climate emergency that leads to the systems change that we need to actually reduce global emissions.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist and author who gave up flying in 2012 and started the site noflyclimatesci.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. WESA's Split Ticket series looks at how key issues resonate in Western Pennsylvania. Polling shows that healthcare is a top concern. And 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins talked with two voters who want to expand government healthcare and two who don't, but still turn to public services for help.
Medicare saved Mary Henze's life.
Without Medicare, I'd be dead because they'd have turned me away at the hospital doors.
Mary lives in Jefferson Hills and is in her 50s. She's been on disability for a decade and is HIV positive, two things that allowed her to get on Medicare before she turned 65. She depended on the program when she had a brain tumor and relies on it now while she fights breast cancer. She's been mostly satisfied with her care, but she's unhappy that receiving it means she's dependent on the government.
Heck, I'm in a catch-22 because I don't believe in it and I'm stuck on it. And I hate it.
Mary's a Republican and says she justifies receiving the benefits because she paid into the system for 25 years when she was working. She feels like she could get better care on private insurance, but she supports an approach like the one proposed by Democrat Pete Buttigieg. That allows anyone to opt into Medicare if they want to.
I'm not adverse to giving general benefit, but allow people to choose.
Savannah Henry is 19 and has not had any major medical issues. But she's supportive of Medicare for All, an idea backed by Democrats Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. The proposal would replace the health insurance market with a government-run system that would cover everyone.
A lot of the people who aren't getting health care are people who are like low income, and a lot of the low income people in this country are like the black and brown people who don't get represented. It's all intersectional, so yeah, it's important to me.
Henry's from Erie and is a sophomore at the University of Pittsburgh. She's on her parents' insurance and says health care is not a top concern for people her age. But she says Medicare for All is important for her future.
Student debt is a huge issue that we're definitely facing. And that kind of like ties into like healthcare. Like if you're in this much debt, you're not gonna be able to live because you're gonna have to be paying all these bills and all of that.
I don't believe that healthcare is a human right. I don't.
Republican Ed Swiklinski is in his 40s and lives in Bethel Park with his wife and three kids. He's self-employed in cybersecurity.
Maybe my position sounds very cold or uncaring, but you know, I have had my share of heartaches and heartbreaks and seen my family members sick. I don't think that it's the job of the government to make sure that I have health care.
In fact, Ed and his family don't have insurance, a fact he only discovered after we talked for this story. He's now submitted paperwork for CHIP, the government healthcare program for kids, and is waiting to get a quote from an insurance company. Ed says he's okay with using government services like CHIP because his tax dollars help pay for them. But he doesn't want new taxes to pay for a new program like Medicare for All. He thinks Medicare should be privatized and not run through the government.
Even if everybody deserved health care, Medicare for All isn't going to be a solution to that problem.
But Democrat Linda Bishop disagrees. She says health care is her number one issue as a voter, and Medicare for All is the best possible solution.
You know, in America, there is no reason why we shouldn't have universal health care coverage.
She receives Medicare as a 68-year-old and says it compares very favorably to her experience on private insurance.
I'm on Medicare, and guess what? I'm not afraid of it. It has a 50-year track record, the administrative costs are low, and I'm very happy with my insurance, and I think most people in this country would be too.
Linda says the differences between the Democratic candidates are less important than winning in November.
The real question is, you know, why is candidate Trump trying to tell us that, you know, he's our champion on the healthcare issue, when in fact the truth is exactly the opposite?
While Trump has been in office, congressional Republicans repeatedly tried to abolish the Affordable Care Act without providing an alternative. That law protects people with pre-existing conditions from being charged higher premiums. It allows people to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. Most recently, Trump's proposed budget included more than $100 billion in cuts to Medicare. Republican Mary Henze voted for Trump in 2016, but hopes he doesn't reduce benefits for the program she relies on.
Okay, President Trump, this is not the time to do this. I know money has to be cut, but don't hurt someone.
She still plans on supporting him in November. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Political dialogue in this polarized age can feel futile. Republicans and Democrats share less common ground now than at any point in the last 20 years. That's according to the Pew Research Center. As a part of Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 series, reporter Laura Benshoff takes us to a conservative corner of South Central Pennsylvania, where red, blue, and others come together.
Lance Walker says he's not a fast barber, but customers at his shop in Chambersburg don't mind.
I believe I'm a good barber, but for me, speed was never really the issue. When you come here, you know that you're going to be engaging in conversation.
Case in point is Bill Harris. He's lost his hair and so doesn't need a cut at all anymore. He's a big liberal and comes in now just to play devil's advocate.
When somebody goes Christian, I go Muslim automatically. If there's a bunch of Muslims in here, I'm going Christian.
Across the room, customer Rich Carbaugh shakes his head and laughs. He has his camo hat on, like he's ready to leave, but says he and Bill have been caught up in conversation.
I'm conservative, and he's not.
So we
get into some good conversations.
Good conversations, yeah.
We agree to disagree on most things.
Chambersburg is in a conservative Christian area, the seat of Franklin County, where about 71% of voters went for President Trump in 2016. But this corner of so-called red America is also home to groups sometimes overlooked. There's a large immigrant population, and the borough's 12% black. Lance's barbershop, with its homey plaid curtains and a sign that says no profanity, is a place where he says people with different politics and backgrounds mix.
I take responsibility for creating an atmosphere and being intentional about having conversations and hard conversations, because I think with the, when you just see the divide that's going on right now in the country.
Lance is 53. He's a former tanker in the Army and a one-time competitive bodybuilder. He's a dad of three. He's been running the barbershop out of his house for nearly 14 years and encourages customers to bring up and debate thorny issues. For example, Rich, who's white, had been asking Lance and Bill, both black, about a certain racial slur.
The N-word.
Right.
Why is it wrong? Why? I know it's wrong on my end, but why can you all talk about it and, right, and it be all right?
Lance listens attentively and thanks him for the conversation. The barbershop is a place where these discussions can be productive. Out in the wider world, Lance says it can be a struggle to point out discrimination and bigotry while not being stereotyped as an angry black man.
So there's certain ways that I have to hold myself that I can't even advocate for my child, you know, the way that I would like to without it being misconstrued as a, oh, he's about to, what's going to happen here, you know, he's going to get violent or whatever.
But Lance says he wants to keep talking. He knows people can change their minds because he has. He was raised in a Christian household and taught to treat everyone with grace and mercy. As an adult, he's voted Republican and is strongly against abortion. Then, in 2016, he found himself repeating the harsh rhetoric used by then-presidential candidate Donald Trump towards Hillary Clinton and other political opponents.
Crooked Hillary Clinton.
Lance realized he couldn't bring these two sides of himself together, the side that reveled in us versus them hostility, and the side that wanted to live his Christian values.
So I'm trafficking in this hatred towards this different people, and in the middle of my dinner, I was just like, this light bulb clicked on, like, Lance, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Since that day in 2016, Lance says he's been trying to be a connector and not a divider by encouraging dialogue locally. That means pulling people out of their online echo chambers. And his barbershop is part of that calling. Customer Lamar Best says he, like more than two-thirds of Americans, has news fatigue.
When news comes on at home, I don't want my daughter to hear what Trump did and what's happened, so I just change the channel at home. But and this is the only place you ever hear me talk about anything political.
For Bill Harris, the bald regular, as much as he likes to stir the pot, he says he gets a lot out of these conversations.
But, you know, as you develop those relationships, you find that, well, maybe I can moderate on a few things that I'm not always right.
Right.
They sit back and listen while Lance steers the discussion from policing,
mass incarceration, and unjust laws,
to welfare.
That we do. I'm more worried about this nickel and dime over here than these billions over there. It was that type
to Hitler.
It's like Germany had enough sense to know that, okay, we probably should get rid of the swastika because it's not. We're doing the usual.
With the fade, right?
Fade, yeah. Okay. So Germany.
All without missing a hair. From Walker's Barbershop, I'm Laura Benshoff for Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 Project is election year coverage that puts people, not politicians, at the center. You can find more at whyy.org/embedded2020. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been about 7 years since two trails were completed to link Pittsburgh and Washington, D.C. Now, biking enthusiasts are hoping for progress in a similar link between Erie and Pittsburgh. Chris Ziegler is the executive director of Armstrong Trails, which just received a $35,000 grant from the Rails to Trails Conservancy, and she joins us on the line. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
I am well, thank you. The grant will be used for repairs to the Brady Tunnel. What's going to be done?
Specifically for the Rails Trails Conservancy grant, the money will go towards the repair and rebuilding of a sluice, which is a trough which catches water and takes it over the portal of the tunnel.
So damage has been done because of water that's been leaking into the tunnel? Is that what's happened?
That is true. Decades worth, I believe. Instead of the going down the trough and over the tunnel, it goes down the face, and in the winter time can create ice and freeze thaw issues and also crack the portal stones, which have been there for 105 years.
So what's it look like right now?
Right now, it's got some ice running down the side of it. We have a bit of a concern should we get a really cold snap that the portal stones will start cracking. And the sluice itself is non-functioning.
The idea of diverting water is an important phase of this project. When does that work begin on the sluice, the trough, if you would? And when might that phase be completed?
We're actually opening bids on Tuesday and expecting to give the contractor a notice to proceed by the end of March. They will fabricate the trusses, which is the metal part that holds the wooden box in the air, in their shop. So they can do that within the month of April. And I anticipate them to erect it starting May and be completed by the end of May, early June.
This work.
So quickly.
This quick work is just part of the tunnel renovations. What must be done and how much is the whole tunnel project going to cost?
The whole tunnel project, we're guestimating between $5 and $6 million. We actually just completed a phase one that started in September of last year. We received a DCNR grant for $829,000, which included the engineering and design of the entire tunnel and lining with a steel liner in the northern portal, covering a 20-foot hole, which that sluice has also failed, and decades of water running in actually created a hole in the ceiling of the tunnel. And that has all been repaired as of December of this past year. Moving forward, I do have some additional money from DCNR that we received this year that will extend the liner another around 100 feet. And then of course, take care of the water issues on the southern portal.
The tunnel is strictly for bikes and runners. Why is it a key to linking trail segments?
Without the tunnel, there really isn't an Erie to Pittsburgh or any other trail system. There is not a bypass. If you go through East Brady to try to get to the northern portal, it is owned by a private landowner, and there are also some homes on that corridor. And much like the railroad's decision way back when to build the tunnel was, the corridor from East Brady to the northern part of that is really not safe. There are a lot of landslides. The corridor is pretty narrow. The tunnel, that's why the railroad invested in the tunnel, and that's why we're investing in the tunnel.
You're hoping to allow cyclists through before the work is completely done. How will you make sure it's safe?
With our engineer, we're devising a plan on maybe using some netting in areas. Actually, the middle of the tunnel is in really great condition. So there's some spalling on the sides, which you don't have to worry about falling on your head. But we anticipate to use some netting and routinely inspect the tunnel to make sure it is safe for trail users.
Do the trail users, the cyclists in general, tend to be from the region? Is there a wider ranging outdoor tourism component?
There is an outdoor tourism component. I think everybody is aware of what the Great Allegheny Passage economic impact numbers are. Those small towns had no industry and had no way to bring tourism in until the trails were there. And that's sort of what this can do. Restaurants will open, outfitters will start businesses, even kayaking on the river will increase. Cyclists are a unique group of people that they really want to travel trail system to trail system. It's not stealing from one system to another. It's just adding to the list. Right. Industrial Heartlands Trail Coalition is 1,500 miles, and it's a multi-state trail. And then there's PA Wilds, which is another 230. And then the Erie to Pittsburgh is the 270. So cyclists will seek out these multi-trail systems, much like Pittsburgh to D.C.
All right. We have just about a minute left. When Erie to Pittsburgh trail system is completed, give me one highlight that people should look for.
One highlight. Oh, that's hard because all the trails that are in this system are very unique and have different features. And like from the Armstrong Trails perspective, we have a lot of railroad history. We have a coaling tower. We have a half mile railroad tunnel. We have an operational turntable. Each trail right. system has a unique feature. So right. I can't pick out one. I can tell you mine.
Well, go ahead quickly.
I just did the half-mile railroad tunnel, all the railroad history.
Okay. Briefly, Chris, you are a cyclist. When do you hope you will be able to make that 270-mile ride from Erie to Pittsburgh?
We have a campaign going to have 90% complete in 10 years. So I'm going to go by that campaign right now.
All right.
We can hope for sooner.
Chris Ziegler is the executive director of Armstrong Trails. Thanks, Chris, and happy biking.
Hey, thank you so much.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's the start of a new season. No, spring isn't here yet, and the regular baseball season doesn't begin for another few weeks. Fish fry season is underway, and once again, the Incline is pitting fish fry against fish fry in a March Madness-style bracket. Rosalind Culgan is the director for the online publication. Good morning, Rosalind.
Good morning. It's my favorite season of the year.
All right. Full disclosure to you and our listeners, I am the fish fryer for my parish. That's F-R-Y-E-R, not F-R-I-A-R. How many years has the Incline been doing this, the brackets?
This is our third year, and the past two competitors are actually not competing this year, so it's time for a new champion.
You have four categories, fire halls and social clubs, churches in the city, churches in the suburbs, and eateries. How did you settle on the 32 competitors that make up those four categories?
Every year it's a nomination process, so we ask readers to nominate their favorites. We had more than 100 nominations this year, and then we actually seed the bracket, just like March Madness style. So the people that got the most nominations are likely to make it to the Final Four. However, there have certainly been surprises in years past. Last year, the group that won was actually seeded seventh, so you never know what could happen.
Underdog comes through.
That's right.
I got to tell you, I have a bone to pick with you, and it's not a fish bone. When you get to your Final Four, there are professional food providers competing against nonprofits, amateurs, who only do this for six Fridays during Lent. That might not be the most even competition. Why?
Well, we wanted to give a chance for eateries to compete, too. And I know that is a bit controversial, and Reddit has had a lot to say about that. But we wanted to give them a chance. They are only a quarter of the bracket, and an eatery has never won, but we'll see if that happens.
It's up to your readers.
That's right.
So when people fill out those other brackets, you know, the NCAA basketball tournament, some of us make our picks with our hearts and not necessarily our heads. Do you think people approach these brackets the same way, maybe loyalty over actual taste?
It's a good question. So we encourage readers to think about each fish fry holistically. So we want them to think about the food, think about the experience, the service. But I think if your neighborhood is on here, you're more likely than not going to vote for your neighborhood. But we also do have readers who will sort of make this a scavenger hunt, and they'll use the bracket to find a different fish fry that they haven't explored before and then, you know, vote if it kind of interests their heart or interests their stomach.
All right. So do you vote? Does your staff vote?
We do not. We thought it would be a conflict of interest, but I do eat at the fish fries.
Speaking just like a great journalist.
Thank you.
So how can readers participate? How can they vote?
Yes, readers can vote on our website. It's theincline.com. This is one instance where you can vote early and vote often. You can vote as many times as you like. So we're close to 1,000 votes so far. We've just started on Tuesday.
And when is it done? Because the fish fries really get underway tomorrow.
That's
Friday.
Right. So readers can vote for this first round through Tuesday at noon, and then we'll take about a day and a half to tabulate the votes, and then we'll come back with the sweet or salty, in this case, 16 on the following Thursday.
And do people sort of, will they be able, as the winners advance, be able to have a chance to then vote later on?
Yes, you can vote in any round you like, as often as you like. If you want to vote in the Final Four, but you haven't voted in the past, that's just fine.
Rosalind Culgan is the director of the Incline. We'll have a link to their bracket on our website, WESA.FM. Thanks, Rosalind.
Thank you.
And let the frying begin. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find us online anytime at WESA.FM/confluence. This and every episode of the program is available via podcast, so download, rate, and review us wherever you tune in. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski.
Production assistance from Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.